Hello. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This is Karen Edwards for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Modern Maturity. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from various sources. So let's start with an article from AARP magazine, and it's about Kevin Costner. Hop in the truck and let's chat with this all-American leading man as he chases ideas down rabbit holes, shoots the cliches out of Westerns, and pursues the best of work of his career. And this article is by Allison Glock. Kevin Costner's landline is ringing. "I haven't heard that phone in a century," he says, chuckling. "I didn't even know there was a phone in this room." Costner, 65, has squirreled himself away in a home office for our call, carving our private space as best he can from his wife, Christine Bumgardner, and their three kids, Caden, 13, Hayes, 11, and Grace, 10, all of whom are quarantining at their Santa Barbara home. Along with the retro trill of the ghost phone, the ambient laughter and chatter of a lively family filling the background air, accompanied by the persistent bark of at least one dog. So it is during COVID-19, where work from home often means working around real life. Not that Oscar and Emmy winner Costner minds. Both as a creative artist and a family man, he prefers the messy unpredictability of reality. Listen, the hallmark of a real conversation is how straight can we talk with each other, he says bluntly, cutting through any formalities. Costner considers chit-chat tiresome at best. He dislikes empty nonsense in his life, avoids it in his profession. Now, more than ever, he prefers getting to the root and says honesty is what makes a thing worth doing. Costner broke out as an actor in the 1980s, after bringing surprising pathos to a string of leading man roles in The Untouchables, Bull Durham, and Field of Dreams. The streak continued with his epic Dances with Wolves, a love letter to integrity that he directed and starred in, netting him Academy Awards for both. Ever since, Costner has gravitated toward authenticity, injecting his particular brand of accessibility masculinity into the pop culture bloodstream. "I have a tendency to go down rabbit holes," he says, of his creative choices. That embrace of spontaneity and nuance, and more critically, his faith in the audience's intelligence and curiosity, is why Costner's work, at its best, transcends cliché. Even in the cliché-laden genres of Westerns and sports narratives. His films linger in the public consciousness. His unfussy performances prick like the spines on a cucumber vine, unnoticed until they pierce your skin and lodge there. As a working-class kid growing up in the margins of L.A., Costner understood the difference between fakery and truth, between pretense and character. He never forgot. His entrance into acting was steered not by a longing for fame, so much as a hope for connection. Early in his career, Costner said no more than yes, argued over dialogue that ran false to his ear, ballsy moves that would have sunk lesser talents. He wasn't worried. He was either going to succeed as he saw fit or not at all. Accountability is bedrock for Costner. There's a reason he's played so many decent men. Any actor will tell you that embodying the good guy is far harder than depicting the villain. Yet Costner has given us both believable men and men to believe in. "It's not important for me to reinvent history or to set the record straight," he says of his approach, "only for people to witness the full spectrum of humanity, good, bad, and every shade in between, and to find themselves within it. I want people to think, that could have been me really easy. and if it were me, what would I have done? Costner relishes a moral quandary. This summer, he's returning to the screen as John Dutton, the patriarch of a ranching family in season 3 of the Paramount Network series Yellowstone. And in the fall, he'll play George Blackledge, a retired sheriff faced with an impossible choice in the illegal Western noir Let Him Go. In each role, Costner plays a deeply ethical man who, for better or for worse, lives resolutely in the pocket of who he is, much like the actor himself. Question. We're talking during a pandemic. What's the biggest lesson you think we should take away from this time? Answer. Government has to be anticipatory. Anticipating problems is the key to being a leader. I know that sounds like a simple word, anticipation, but that's what we expect. Thoughtful leadership that does not involve ego, does not involve career extension, any of that. If you're in public service, you can't put yourself first. If you do that, that's wrong. Question. Do these concerns weigh on you as a parent? Answer. Yes. I worry about all the things that go with being a provider. What if this doesn't happen? What if this does happen? I'm a bit of a survivalist. I'm not a prepper. I'm not a hoarder. But it's important to me to anticipate things going wrong and make the best move for my family, for my extended family and friends. I take that all on. Sometimes what you think you can protect is a bit of an illusion, but there's a lot of problems that could be solved with common sense. About 20% of our problems may not have a solution, but 80% of our problems are manageable and we just haven't managed them. Question. You have 7 children, including 3 with first wife Cindy Silva and 1 with former girlfriend Bridget Rooney. What do you want most to teach them? Answer. I want my children to know I'm a resource to them, that I have been across the river a lot of times. I can tell them the rocks that move and the rocks that don't. As a father, you don't give yourself a badge or a medal for any of the things you do. In fact, your kids will probably be the first ones to tell you the things you haven't done. And good for them. If they recognize that, that's a bucket that they don't have to step into themselves. I want to see what kind of people my kids become. I don't care what they do. I want to see who they are. Question. Character. Answer. That's right. I think about Lincoln on that train ride to Gettysburg, pinning his address and listening to that a-hole before him speak for over an hour and a half, who was just drubbing him. And then Lincoln sitting there looking at his puny 270 words or whatever they were and thinking, oh man, I've miscalculated here. And it stands forever. Forever. Question. What drew you to make Let Him Go, a dark Western Gothic set in 1951? You play a grieving father. Answer. It felt honest. The Western is not based on one person's story. It's based on something that probably happened thousands of times. The first Western I did, Silverado, wasn't history. It was a good matinee fun. Later on, I did Wyatt Earp, which was more biographical. My Western, Open Range, was based on a novel, yet the conflict it showed between free grazers and the people who were fencing in land with barbed wire could have played out 1,000 times. Just because something is fiction doesn't mean you can't find yourself in it. Question. Your new film explores the sacrifices parents make. Did you have a good relationship with your folks? Answer. My dad was pretty tough. My mom was the one that would let me know things were possible. I was a bit of a rascal, a dreamer. I remember stealing a piece of candy one time. I was 6 or 7 years old. Before we left the store, my dad said, I think you need to put that candy back. Why did you take it? I said, I was hungry. And he said, it's not yours. So the correct title is, you stole it. His point was, you can justify anything, but if you put the correct title on it, it will help guide your decisions in life. Question. You're working on a big multi-film project. Answer. I'm pushing the rock uphill. It's four movies, all the same story, and it takes you to a place that you think you know, but you don't. I have it in my pocket as a great big secret that someday I will let people in on, and hopefully it will be something they never forget. Question. Why is fighting for creativity integrity so important to you? Answer. I have been tested in a lot of different ways. There have been very critical moments when I had to listen to myself and act and not be afraid of the outcome. I always put the audience on my shoulder. And I will say to Hollywood people, don't be too sure they don't want to see that. And that's what the fight is about. I haven't always been really successful in certain movies, but I still love it. Question. You and your country rock band, Modern West, have recorded an album called Tales from Yellowstone. Answer. I grew up singing and playing music in the church, so that was my first love. The first band I was in my 20s, and it was called Roving Boy. I was emerging as an actor, and I got a terrible review, and it really shocked me. I thought to myself, do I need this kind of scrutiny? You know, the actor playing music, so I stepped away. Question, what got you back into music? Answer, my wife, Christine, discovered that early music and asked me, why don't you do this? And I said, oh, no, no, no. For 2 years, I backed away from it. She said, are you happy when you're doing it? And I said, yeah. And she goes, do you think the people in front of you are happy? And I said, yeah. And she just looked at me and said, well, what could be wrong with that? So I called up two members of the original band. We've been playing together for the last 16 years. Question, what do you wish you were better at? Answer, getting it right. Question, it seems you're getting a lot right. Yeah, but those things you don't, they can really foul you up. I plan to play out the second half of my career with big movies that have a level of poetry. There's a perception out there that I can do whatever I want, that things get easier for me professionally with age. It's simply not true. It's just as hard to make things now as it was when I was trying to make dances. But I should do whatever I want. I'm at that point in my life. Artistically, I should be doing what pleases me. Final question. Are we still talking about making movies? Answer. A movie is just something for us to grasp in the dark. Just watching and going, I didn't expect that. I'm glad I saw that. And then you've got to move on to the rest of your difficult day. But I want to be a part of that moment. What we yearn for. We all yearn for. I know that in my heart. Now let's look at another article from the AARP magazine, Emotional Rescues. 9 pet owners, including one best-selling author, reflect on how companion animals make lockdown more bearable. The first one, Karen Brescia, 53, with Max, at her mountain home in Idaho. Every day you need something positive to lift your spirits. Our two Maine Coon cats definitely are a big part of the positive thing. My wonderful sons grew up and moved away, but my pets are definitely like children. When they love you, when they look you in the eyes, it's like they look right into your soul. And Max, who's 2 years old, is wrapped around this Karen's shoulders, and she has a huge smile on her face. The cat probably does too. Next, Robin Webb, 63, with Pups, who's about 4 years old, and Jimmy Webb, 66, with Penny, who's 14 weeks. This is from Cleveland, Mississippi. Jimmy came to live with me and Pups 2 years ago. brought a 12-year-old dachshund who was the love of our lives until she passed away in December. And then my mother died the next day. There was this big sense of loss for all of us, so we decided pups needed a little sister. Jemmy and I felt extremely blessed that we're together in this pandemic, not alone as we were for many years. Now, we have the opportunity to create a family with two dogs and the two of us. So there's a picture of the two men and their two dogs. Now, Jamie Gershon, who's 32, is shown here with Criso, who's 4, and they're from Miami, Florida. At the end of January, my friend Agenot passed away at the age of 56, and she left me her dog. Then came quarantine. I went from working all the time as a photographer and filmmaker to uncertainty about when I would get my next gig. On walks with Criso, I began to look around, finally seeing my neighborhood, where I had meant to take walks for years, and I realized what I had been missing. I hadn't been noticing the butterflies flutter. I hadn't known many of my neighbors or even seen cardinals in the trees. After Criso's mama passed, I thought I was doing her a favor by looking out for him. But in this time, I've come to understand that she sent him to look out for me. And there's a picture of them in a chair with Criso in her lap. Cute little, I don't know what kind it is, so. Next we have Kathy C. Bennett, 64, with Harley, who's 11, and they're from Charleston, South Carolina. I'm the therapy dog coordinator for a hospital, and my two golden doodles are certified. They haven't been doing therapy since the pandemic, but life would be much lonelier if I did not have them. My husband and I have lost dear friends to the illness, and the dogs have been a source of comfort, not only to us, but to other people. And there's a picture of her hugging this big white golden doodle dog. And now we have Samantha Kirby, who's 55, with Chupacabra, who's 13. And Chupacabra is a horse. And they're from Burbank, California. The Andalusian breed and the Spanish horses have been my absolute passion for about 25 years. They look spirited, but they're super noble, super gentle. I feel very blessed to have the ability to ride on the trails during the pandemic. For a brief and precious time, I feel at peace. My horses have always been my sanctuary. And it shows her looking at her horse and with her her hand on his cheek, and he's looking down at her. Now we have Patrick Schrodes, 49, with Lancelot, who's 6, and they're from Bethesda, Maryland. We were a two-cat household until our cat Barnaby died suddenly this past spring. My wife and I have a 13-year-old son, and it was his first experience with loss. Thankfully, Lancelot is friendly. As long as you don't touch his belly, he's super chill. But it's always easier to have pets, good times or bads. To have a little animal that you reach down and tickle, or if you're sad, they walk over to you. Whenever they mean anything, whether they mean anything by it or not, you can convince yourself, oh, he gets me. And Lancelot is a kitty cat, kind of grayish and brown. We have Bob Bader, 62, with Penny, who's 1 year old. And they're both laying on the bed with their heads on the pillow, and they're both asleep. We have two cats. This is from Tampa, Florida. We have two cats, and we were worried about introducing the dog with the cats. Now they all get along fine. All of a sudden, pets have 24/7 companionship. She wants to play a lot. And we've met all of our neighbors because she's so adorable. Our lives revolve around Penny sometimes, it seems. It's unprecedented times for us, but I think the dogs will look back on this as their glory days. And it's the dog that's on the bed. And finally, Andy Day, 57, with Handsome, who's nearly 20, and they're from Boise, Idaho. I always had horses, and eventually my kids rode with me, then my grandkids. Handsome worked as a pack string mule at a dude ranch. They retired him, and I took him. I work at a retirement village. When I'm worn out at the end of the day, I see Handsome. When I drive in, he goes, hee-haw, big old Bray. It makes me feel welcome. I admire his honesty. He's upfront with what he's feeling. And this picture shows Andy sitting on top of the horse with a huge smile on her face and an Indian blanket under the saddle. And, excuse me, this is a mule. And the mule with his eyes sort of half closed, like thinking, okay. Now I have an everyday hero, the train conductor. There is one passenger who I have kept in touch with. Paul Kempner takes pride in serving essential workers, but he misses his regulars. Growing up in New York, where everything is hustle and bustle, we always had big crowds to navigate, whether we were walking the streets or riding the trains. And that's the way it was at my job before the pandemic. During rush hour, we used to have more than 700 people riding my trains. I'm a conductor on the Hudson Line out of Grand Central Station. Now it's down to about 60 people, and the drop in ridership was overnight. It seemed surreal. When the trains were more crowded, the ride went a lot quicker because I was constantly moving around. It's a lot different from being a conductor on mass transit. We patrol the trains, collect tickets, sell tickets, operate the doors, make announcements so everybody knows where they're going, help people on and off the train. We make people feel safe. I just started my 22nd year, and you really get to know the riders. The one you speak to on a daily basis become like your railroad family. But I don't see those people right now, and I miss them. People like Bert, a World War II veteran, or his little girl whose mother and father took turns taking her to school near 125th Street in Harlem. I would always draw a smiley face on her seat check. I wonder how big she's going to be the next time I see her. There's one passenger who I have kept in touch with over the course of this time, Mrs. Kessler, a 90-plus-year-old lawyer who was still going into Manhattan to work nearly every day. My last train of the day was her go-home train, so I would hold her bags and help her down the platform. She isn't going into the city for now, but we got each other's numbers, and we text all the time. I heard from her yesterday. The people on the train now, I don't know so much, and conversation is limited because of social distancing. The atmosphere is different, too. But I still take pride in the job I do, which is to get people from point A to point B in the safest possible manner and on time. And I still treat people the way I would want to be treated, help them feel comfortable, maybe even make them smile behind their masks. From that aspect, the job hasn't changed. But the virus, it does change things. People are dying, and if I start thinking about it too much, I'd drive myself crazy. I just try not to be fearful. To quote my wife, no matter how much you plan, anything could happen in a snap of a finger. You could get off the curb and, God forbid, get hit by a car. So I just accept and adapt to what's happening right now and just keep moving forward. So this story was from Paul Kempner, 51, as told to Marilyn Millay. And there's a picture here of him leaning out the window of his train, and he's got his mask on, but you can still see the smile in his eyes. Now, another everyday hero, the sanitation worker. I'm no hero, though maybe my truck is. Sanitation worker Calvin Taylor keeps the cleanup trucks rolling. My job depends on people not doing the right thing. I work in solid waste for the Detroit Department of Public Works, have for 31 years. There's a lot of trash around, and I clean up after people who dump illegally. COVID-19 has forced a lot of our people out of work. Many of my colleagues are out sick right now. We're tested, and the people who have positive tests can't come back to work until they test negative. One manager's husband died from COVID-19, so I'm handling her job. I work as a temporary foreman, handing out the paperwork that lists the locations we need to clean up. I pass out masks and gloves every morning. We work log loaders, front-end loaders, and knuckle boom trucks to pick up tons of debris and take it away. It's one of the few government jobs left for solid waste workers. Private companies took over regular trash pickup after Detroit went bankrupt in 2013. Those companies won't pick up trash from a vacant address, but we will. We don't have a profit margin. Our only motive is keeping the city clean. We see it all. Old furniture, rugs, construction debris. One time, some people pulled up right behind me as I was talking with my supervisor on the phone. They started throwing old TVs over a fence onto a vacant property. On another day, there was this guy emptying his trailer out on the street as I was sitting there in my city sanitation truck. He motioned to me to come to clean it up. People try to report the illegal dumpsters in the act so we can catch them and make them stop. But I can't stop anyone from dumping. It could become unpleasant if I confronted them. I'll be going back to the truck once people come back to work. I'm no hero, though, but maybe my truck is. It does all the heavy work. I do my job to make the city cleaner. There are about 15 guys who do this job. I'm just one of them. Now I have a few more items of sports memorabilia. April 14th, 2019, Tiger Woods completes a comeback from injuries and personal problems to triumph at the Masters. November 2nd, 2016, after a 100-year drought, the Chicago Cubs win a thrilling World Series over Cleveland. June 19, 2016, LeBron James leads the Cleveland Cavaliers to an NBA championship, capping a remarkable homecoming for the Ohio native. November 30, 2013, the Kick Six Auburn quarterback Chris Davis returns a failed field goal attempt by undefeated Alabama, its hated rival, as time expires to win the Iron Bowl. And finally, July 7, 2019, the U.S. women's soccer team beats the Netherlands 2-0 to win a record fourth World Cup title. Folks, we have run out of time for today's episode of Modern Maturity. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Karen Edwards, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Modern Maturity is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again, 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.